Welcome to the Writer's Weekly Podcast, a forum geared toward the writing enthusiast and those who want to make money from their writing. I'm Brian Whidden, Managing Editor of Writer's Weekly, and I'll be your host along with Angela Hoy, the creator of Writer's Weekly and President and CEO of BookLocker.com, a full-service book publishing company. Whether you want to learn how to become a professional writer, how to find writing gigs, or even publish your own book, then you come to the right place. We'll be discussing all kinds of topics relating to the writing and publishing industries. Don't forget, you can also click over to writersweekly.com. There, you'll find not only thousands of articles about professional writing, you can also find current paying markets and job listings to help you boost your writing career and even your bottom line. But for now, let's get on to this episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. And welcome to another episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. I'm Brian Whidden, and here with me is, is Angela Hoy.
Hello. Name that tune. And artist.
I've just got to let you go.
I'm sorry. Hey,
well,
you know the lyrics.
That was Lionel Richie.
Very good.
Hello.
Good job.
The name of the job. Yeah.
I was going to run a contest if you didn't get it and offer somebody a free book, but you blew it. So you blew it for everybody else. So
sorry.
Good job, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know better than to test me on a song from the 80s.
Hey, it wasn't from Def Leppard or something. I thought I had a chance of pulling one over
I did my share of a little Lionel Richie. Yes, I did. In fact, now that I'm an older gentleman, I actually enjoy some of the Commodores.
I do, too.
Who was in the Commodores?
I think it was Five Guys.
Might have been.
Mm-hmm.
Who was one of them?
I don't know.
Lionel Richie. Okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was one of the Commodores.
I didn't know that. Huh. I thought he was just always a solo artist.
No. Huh. You know that song? Now I can't even remember it. Hold on a second. Won't be back this way. Tired of me. Gonna looking for a good time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know that.
Take that out of there. Okay. All right. Today's episode, we are talking about when an author dies, the vultures will rise. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. But first, our home office report for the week.
Yeah. Okay. It was 4 weeks ago today. As long as we're talking about death.
So it wasn't this week, but,
it is actually... No, but it came to a head this
week. It's related to today's...
Yeah.
Came to a head, really?
It came to a head.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this week. 4 weeks ago today, I woke up in the morning, and sometimes this happens to me, these weird things happen, and somebody crossed my mind. It's an old friend of mine who I had not talked to in 15 years, and she is a sister of a boy that I dated in high school. And I don't know why she popped into my head, and I thought, yeah, I should reach out to her on Facebook or something. And then I got up and got my day going and didn't think much about it. On Monday, my phone rang, and her name popped up on the screen. Now, this is another weird thing. I had not talked to her in 15 years. I'd gone through a couple phones since then. She was not a contact on my phone, but her name popped up. I still can't figure that out. Anyway, she called to tell me that her brother, my old boyfriend, had died on Saturday evening. I thought about her on Saturday morning. So we talked for over an hour, you know, had some good memory talk, had some tears, had some laughter. And then we texted back and forth a few times. During the phone call, let me go back a little bit. When I dated him in high school, he was a straight A student, had a really good job. He went on to college. I broke up with him in high school. Went on to college, and shortly thereafter, I guess, dropped out and developed a drinking problem. And I heard through friends of friends that his parents blame me for him drinking because I broke his heart. Of course, you know, I don't know if that is true or not, but it was, you know, the going rumor back in the day. And when I talked to her, that subject came up as well. Anyway, we texted back and forth over the past month, and they were waiting for the cause of death to come out, the medical examiner's website. And I asked Brian, I thought it was odd that she reached out to me after 15 years, but, you know, she'd actually gotten my new phone number from an old friend of ours. And Brian gave me his opinion. Anyway, she reached out to me by text last week and asked if I would pay for his cremation. And I thought that was
ding, 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 ding.
Extremely rude. It's just not something I was willing to do.
And that was the last thing we had thought about when you asked, why do you think she's calling me this late in the game? We came up with all kinds of altruistic
because I hadn't
reasons
dated
why
him
somebody
in
would reach out to you.
42 years.
And we never even thought for a minute, oh, she's calling because she wants money.
Yeah, and maybe that wasn't on her mind that day, but I was extremely floored when she reached out and asked me to pay for his cremation. So, and I said no, politely said no.
Yeah. So, I had to walk Angie through that and get her off the ledge because she was pretty ticked off.
Yeah, I was extremely ticked off. I was like thinking, am I getting scammed or something? However, I did have the information to access his information through the medical examiner's website. And he is deceased. He definitely, and he did die the day that she told me he died. The only other thing that happened this week was we have a door that sticks when it gets humid outside. Every year this time of year, the door sticks a little bit. Well, it stuck the other day and didn't get closed all the way, popped open a little bit. And Rocky the cat got out. And of course, we looked all over the house for Rocky first. By then, it was almost dark. I went outside with a flashlight. I found Rocky standing under the porch stairs. When Rocky gets out, you can't coax him to come towards you. That doesn't work. The closer you get, the faster he's going to walk away. Well, he wasn't looking at me. He was looking at Tank the dog. And the only way to catch Rocky is to grab him by the tail. So I grabbed him by the tail. He turned around, sank all of his teeth into my hand. I still didn't let go of that tail. Then I grabbed his scruff with my other hand. He tried to bite that hand up, but failed, so he went back after my right hand. By the time I had him in my arms in a chokehold, my right hand was all bloody, and I still have 5 holes in my hand. So I won. I got the cat inside, and I think maybe he'll think twice about leaving again. Then again, maybe not.
Here's an online poll I would love for people to respond to. Rocky has gotten out several times. Now, Rocky never goes any farther than the edge of the house. When he gets out, he doesn't like it outside. He gets scared. He'll either hide down in the carport or hide behind a wood pile that we have right next to our house, our wood stack.
He's always right next to the
house. He's always right near the house, hiding somewhere because he freaks out once he gets out there. So it's not like he's disappearing in the woods or roaming the neighborhood. He gets out because he thinks he wants to get out there. Once he's out there, he stays put and he's scared. And we'll get out there and he'll be, meow, meow, meow. And my opinion is the next time he gets out, we just need to leave him out for a night. Let him, he'll come back when he's hungry. Let him spend a night out there with all the scary noises and whatnot going on. And maybe that'll teach him to come on back. Angie's solution is always we all have to jump up, grab flashlights, roam around in the night, chasing this stupid cat around the house from one little nook and cranny to the next little nook and cranny. Sooner or later, I usually have to shove my arm into some corner behind a stack of lumber where there's a bunch of spiders and crap to grab this stupid cat and drag his sorry ass back into my house where I didn't really want him in the first place. Someday we might tell you the story of Rocky and how he became our house cat. But anyway.
Well, everybody needs to know that Rocky jumps on our bed and always cuddles up with you.
Yeah, that's because cats always mess with the person that hates them the most.
You pet him back. I've got so many pictures of you asleep with him on your chest, and you've got your arm draped. You can call him stupid cat all you want, but you love that cat.
Tough love. Leave him outside.
Send us
a little message. Tell us what you think. Should we hunt Rocky or just leave his butt out there?
I'm afraid whatever's killed our rooster and our chickens is going to kill Rocky too.
Well,
so.
Rocky ain't a chicken. Rocky can run. Rocky can climb a tree if he has to. Rocky can't even bite, as you know.
He bit me.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Y'all let us know what you think. Should we let Rocky outside for one night and see what happens? I told Brian I'd rather have a dead cat than a missing cat.
Tough love. Just leave him out there. He'll learn. He'll figure it out.
You know I'm going to win.
That's just like the time that I snuck out of my house in the middle of the night, and I came back, and my dad had locked all the doors and windows.
Oh,
I had
wow.
to come to the front door and knock to get back in at 4 in the morning.
But that turned out well for you.
That was a fun night.
Yeah.
A fun night. Okay, so on with our episode. That was our home office report for the week. not only is it important to have a will and even better a trust in which to place your assets upon your demise, but it's also extremely important to include your book's copyrights in that document, as well as to appoint something like a trust or one of your beneficiaries to receive your future royalties. Angela, tell us about that.
Well, we're going to get in some personal stories about authors that we're not going to name here, even though they're all dead. Let me give you an example of what happens to families when people die. My dad died when I was 5. My brother was 6. His parents died shortly thereafter. They left everything in their will to my brother and I. By the time my mother was able to get on a plane and fly up to Indiana where they lived, everything of value in their house was gone. My great uncle had gone in and stripped everything, taken everything, even though everything was left to my brother and I. My mother had to go to court and fight to get a special rocking chair. My grandpa was a retired police officer. He had a gun collection. She got that. She had to go to court for that. And they had a Tiffany lamp. Now, I don't know what happened to the rocking chair. My brother ended up with a gun collection. I ended up with a Tiffany lamp. It's worth a lot of money. I can tell you it's the ugliest thing anybody's ever seen. It looks like stained glass made out of smeared peanut butter and jelly.
I don't know why anybody pays the money that those things are getting.
Other antiques
it's
and everything.
Crazy.
So none of our adult kids wants that Tiffany lamp, despite the value. So it is specified in my will which kid gets it, and none of the kids are going to know until I die. So, yeah, and it's the kid's probably going to be thinking that child was the least liked, but it's just because I think that child will think it's the funniest. So, yeah. So if you don't take specific steps to secure your assets once you die, your relatives can still have problems. And we actually get into this with this episode. I do want to add that we're not lawyers. If you need a lawyer about your specific situation, hire your own lawyer. We're not lawyers. However, we've been dealing with these types of fights between relatives after an author dies for, 26 years now. So,
So well, let's discuss some examples of this egregious conduct by the relatives of some of our authors who have passed. So, let's see. Tell me about the two greedy and really dumb relatives who went to court over one of our author's books.
Okay, we had an author who died. This was before we had a beneficiary clause in our contract. This is the reason why we put one in our contract. This author, he died. Two relatives contacted me. Both of them demanded to know how many royalties the author had earned, how sales were going, what the unpaid royalties were. I couldn't divulge that information to those relatives because I didn't have any court paperwork.
He didn't have anything indicating that those were the people that you were to give information to, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, it hadn't gone through the probate process yet. So I didn't know who to tell what. I couldn't tell. It's a privacy thing. I couldn't tell them anything.
Yep.
Before the will even went to probate, they went to court and sued each other. trying to get control of the author's unpaid royalties and copyrights. Watching them email me for months and months and each other and fighting with each other and arguing with me and me knowing all along, me and all my employees knew all along, the amount of money in unpaid royalties was less than $60 and they were paying thousands for attorneys. I just laughed and laughed because it was pure greed. It was absolutely pure greed. After they found out it was less than $60, neither one wanted the rights to the book. They dropped everything. And, of course, we had to take the book off the market because nobody was controlling it anymore. So after that is when we decided to change our contract.
What most people don't understand, I have learned in this industry, and you probably knew this long before I figured it out, everybody assumes because you wrote a book that you're making a bunch of money off of it, and it just isn't true. Some books make a lot of money, some don't.
Yeah.
But everybody, so if you think that as an author, when you die, all of your relatives are you know, unless you've told them how much money you're actually making from the book, I hate to say it, but they're all going to assume you were just raking in the dough because you had a book out there. And I'm not saying that your relatives are bad people. It's just that's the assumption people make. It's almost like if you tell people that you've been on TV, they think somehow you're making all kinds of money. But you may have been somebody that got that made a commercial for something and you got paid that one time for that one commercial and that's it. And maybe it was a couple $1,000s.
And I bet a lot of authors don't run around saying, I made this much money. I made that much money.
Well, exactly.
And as you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't tell people how much money.
Well, you know, you go through all that trouble writing a book and let's say you only made $60 in 2-3 years that it's been out there. You're not going to run around telling everybody, yeah, I wrote this whole book and I only sold $60 worth. Mm-hmm. You're not going to tell people that.
True. Right?
You know, you're just going to keep telling people I got a book out and hopefully they'll buy it too.
Yeah.
So don't. You know, I'm telling you, your relatives, once you're gone, they're going to assume there's thousands and thousands of dollars waiting for them to collect.
Some of them will. And we're not just talking about adult kids. We're talking extended relatives.
Yeah.
Who, even if it went through probate and there was a pecking order, you know, spouse, kids, stepkids, you know, grandkids, they're so far down the food chain, they come out of the woodwork.
So let's move on to why it's important for publishers to have a beneficiary clause in their contracts.
Because as we learned the hard way, the probate process, if it goes through probate, if you've got everything in a trust, you might not have to go to probate. And that's the way our lawyer recommended everything being a trust. Probate can take a very long time, months, possibly even years, depending on what's involved. In the meantime, who's controlling the author's books and who's getting the royalties? Well, if it's all part of the will, the publisher's just basically juggling this stuff, holding on to it until they get some kind of paperwork that says this person is now in charge of this author's estate. Many times, the author does have a will or a trust or both, and they forgot to include their copyrights in their will and trust. They just, something they didn't ever even thought about.
Yeah, you have to think of that copyright as an asset.
It is. It
just
definitely
like
is
any,
an
just
asset.
Just like anything, like a car or a house, it is an asset. It may not be worth a whole lot. It might be.
And the author may have unpaid royalties that the publisher can't distribute until the everything goes through the courts. And so that's also an asset. So unpaid royalties. Having a beneficiary clause in a publisher's contract cuts back on unnecessary and downright hostile emails from authors' immediate and even extended relatives. When I'm able to say, and again, we'll give examples in a minute that are pretty awful and entertaining. When I'm able to say, look, I have the author's contract. You're not listed as a beneficiary. I will not discuss this with you. I've had lawsuit threats for saying that. And my response is always, have your attorney contact me.
Yep.
And that's when it ends, because they don't want to pay $300 an hour or whatever to have somebody discuss this back and forth with me. But I can't legally disclose that information to anybody until a court tells me who to disclose that to. So.
So in one case, I guess the daughter of a dead author was actually being bullied by a group of people. You want to talk about that?
Yep. One of our authors died, and she had a daughter who was an adult. The daughter was a beneficiary of everything. Daughter got everything when the woman died, and she was a beneficiary in our contract. The author belonged to a writer's group.
Mm-hmm.
The writer's group were not friends of the daughter, but they knew the daughter, and they bullied and harassed this woman for a very long time, saying that her mother wanted them to have the rights to her books.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to take control of the books. And the daughter just, after a while, just gave up and signed over rights to the writing group because she was bullied and bullied and bullied. They had no rights to those books whatsoever.
Yeah.
And they just harassed and harassed and harassed this poor young woman until she finally gave up. And she contacted me and told me she was signing over. She had to sign her contract and, you know, sign it over to this other group. And we terminated the books because we didn't want to work with that group of people.
Oh, good.
I mean, it's hard enough when there's two or three beneficiaries. Like if somebody dies, an author, and it's my two sons and my daughter, and, you know, juggling all that. Can you imagine 10 unrelated people belonging to a writer's group? And this one, I wanted to change this description to this. No, I want to change that to that.
Lord.
Plus, the way that they treated that woman, mm-hmm. there are certain people, and Brian, you hear me talk about this all the time. We had one just the other day, that based on their personality, I absolutely refuse to work,
with them.
There is no amount of money that you can pay me to make it worth working with, you know, narcissists, people with borderline psychological, whatever that's called. I mean, it's just, it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it. I'd rather make less money and have a nice, peaceful day every day than deal with people like that. And I was not going to deal with that writer's group because I received some of the emails they sent to that woman and it was just horrible.
Yeah. There you go. And I think we have two cases where there was outright fraud used in an attempt to steal authors' royalties. Tell us about that.
The absolute worst one, and I've talked about this before and I've written about it, got an email from a man and he said, my father is your author so-and-so and he died and I need you to start sending his royalties to me. So I responded to the guy. Now, I get these emails all the time and I've got a couple more examples in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I respond to that person. First of all, I look up the contract to see if that person is actually the beneficiary. 99% of the time, it's not.
Nope.
Okay. In this case, he was. However, I wrote back to him just to ask for some more information, and I copied his father's email address on it.
Mm-hmm.
Almost immediately got an email from his father saying, I'm not dead. And then he redid his contract and made somebody else a beneficiary, but he was very much alive and his son was trying to steal from him.
Yeah.
Here's one of what I just referenced. This author's niece wrote to me, emailed me, claimed to be the author's beneficiary. The author had died.
Yeah.
His wife was a beneficiary on his contract. The niece actually claimed in her email that she was the only surviving relative.
Mm.
Boy, his wife was very surprised to hear that when I contacted her. So, and again, I get these all the time.
Yeah.
Not just when authors die. Sometimes they're still alive. And these people have no claim on anything, and they think they do. Thank the good Lord that we included that beneficiary clause way 20-something years ago when we did. I receive, again, dozens of these types of emails. Every year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you seen any fraud by individuals that the author hired to help them during the publishing process?
Yeah, it's not unusual for an author to hire, there's a growing number of publishing reps out there, and they actually hire them to hold your hand through the process. If you use booklocker.com, you don't need a rep.
No,
we will hold your hand.
We hold your hand pretty well.
Anyway, this person had hired an editor to edit her book. And then the editor offered to act as an author rep and help the author through the publishing process, which she didn't need at BookLocker, but the woman accepted the help anyway, and I'm sure, I don't know how much she paid for it. The author let the editor complete her BookLocker contract. Now, that wouldn't be recognized in a court of law because the author didn't actually read and complete the contract.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed something odd in that contract. Usually the beneficiary, because it says, you know, relationship. What they are, right? And I noticed something odd. The relationship was editor. It was the editor's name, address, phone number, email address, and the name editor. And I went, okay, this is a new one. I haven't seen this. So I wrote to the author through her author account in our system. She had no idea that her editor had made herself the beneficiary in the contract. So editor got fired, and we got a new contract from the author that was actually valid. And it was her kids. She wanted her adult kids to be the beneficiaries.
If you're an author out there, you would actually be shocked at how many incidents we've seen where an author hired somebody to represent them or, you know, edit something or and that person does anything but represent that author. You can tell they're just an egomaniac,
mm-hmm.
and it's all about, listen to me, let me tell you what the author wants to do. And a lot of times we'll reach out to the author and they'll turn out, well, I didn't say that. Well, and eventually we've had authors that say, talk directly to me. Don't talk to my rep.
That actually happened not long ago.
Why are you to fire that person then? Talk to us. We will work with you. What you tell us, we will do.
Yeah.
If it's at all feasible, we will do it. Yeah. But we get these quote unquote reps who come in and start demanding this and demanding that and insisting that this and that. And then if we actually reach out to the author, they're like, wait a minute, I didn't ask for all that.
They don't really bully us. They bully the author.
They do. Yeah.
And the author's paying them by the hour to be bullied.
Yeah, exactly.
If you've got a author rep and you feel like you're not quite sure things are going right, you need to contact us.
Yeah.
Writersweekly.com/ click on the contact us button at the top. And we won't contact the rep. We won't publicize anything. But if you just tell us what's going on, we'll have seen it before or we haven't. And we'll let you know if we think you're getting ripped off. We'll also let you know if you actually need that service from that person.
Well, that's the thing is, and I don't know, I don't know how much reps are needed to deal with other publishing companies, but, you ask us for something. If we can do it, we will do it. If we can't do it, we will tell you we can't do it, and we will tell you why we can't do it.
And we'll refer you to somebody who can.
There are some things that people demand that just simply can't be done for legal reasons or any other reason.
It's a whole nother episode.
It's amazing what some people ask us to do.
Oh, but man.
We will tell you, no, we can't do that.
Yeah.
If there's an alternative, we can say, but we can do that. You don't need a rep. Mm-hmm. It's so crazy.
I can tell you that the most problematic projects we work on are ones with authors who have reps.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ones we work on with authors, everything goes smooth as butter.
For the most part. Yeah. Straight us author. Mm-hmm. It's just a back and forth and, hey, can we do this? Yeah, sure. We can do that. I'd like to see this and this. Yep. We can make that happen too.
Yeah, sure.
Well, you don't need a third party to come in between us and you.
Yeah.
And,
Oh, I had another
one.
What
other one you got? Yep.
So an elderly author, and a lot of authors are elderly. People wait until later in life to be able to write a book.
When you have
time to write a book.
You got the time to sit down and write a book. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've got life experiences.
Yeah. And we love all of our authors, and we have a special place in our hearts for all the grandpas and grandmas, So this elderly author filled out her contract. I look at every contract when they come through, and she put her rep's name as a beneficiary. So I wrote to her privately, and I was basically like, what's up with that? Don't you have kids or a spouse? And she said, well, I have kids, but she said if I made her my beneficiary in my contract, that she would make sure to distribute the royalties to all my kids if I die. BS.
Big red flag right there.
Her kids and grandkids and any relatives who she wanted to have her royalties and rights, they weren't ever going to get a penny.
And she should have fired that person right there on the spot for even requesting such a thing.
Yep.
Here's the thing. You hire, say, a lawyer to be the executor of your trust or will. Mm-hmm. That person has what's called a fiduciary responsibility to you. Mm-hmm. They must do what you ask them to do, or they can be held accountable under criminal law for not doing that.
Right.
A publishing representative or consultant.
By the way, there's no license or
there's
or anything for that.
There's no.
It's just a fancy title.
There's
for,
no license. There's no certification. There's no classes. There's nothing.
Right.
There's just somebody that claims they know the publishing process and they're going to walk you through it. That person has zero responsibility to do anything that you expect them to do.
And if she took the author's royalties, she'd be completely entitled to them based
because
on the contract.
She listed them as a beneficiary.
And that's she could walk away and not give money to the kids at all, and nothing would happen to her.
In a court of law, it would not fly. They would get that money, and they do not have to give it to anybody else. Not your children, not your nobody.
Right, but if a lawyer did something like that to
you,
they could go to jail
then
for
it. Right. They're fraudulent, and they'll go to jail. But not a publishing consultant. So think about that when you're hiring these reps and consultants and everything. You still have to be very involved in the process.
Yes, absolutely.
To make sure that person's not screwing you over.
Yeah, right.
So, and that's not to say there aren't maybe some good reps out there, but from what we've seen, it's not really necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
So what other shady things have relatives done, Angie?
Well, I think the one that we've encountered the most is we get an email from a completely different email address where somebody claims to be the author and they want to change their contract, or they want to change their PayPal email address where the royalties are paid, or they want to change their bank account where the royalties are going. The ones that claim to be the author but come from a different email address are almost always an extended relative of the author, because I don't reply to that email. I go to the author's account in our system.
And we contact them through our own internal system.
Right.
They get a notification at the email address that they gave us to have those notifications sent to.
Right. Yeah. And often we have more than two email addresses for each author in case, you know, spam filters. So when we post a message to our author system, they instantly get an email saying, hey, there's a message waiting for you. Yep. And their extended relative, unless they're really, you know, they've hacked into the author's computer, aren't going to have access to that. When we get emails requesting that we change a PayPal account or bank account information for an author, a lot of them come through saying, please change this for my payroll. They're all gmail.com email addresses, but they're not the author's email addresses. Those are scammers. Now, I caught on to that the first time I saw one. I get them all the time now. In fact, last week, Brian, you emailed me from a strange email address asking me to change your bank account for your paycheck.
Did you?
No.
Oh, okay.
Again, we're seeing this all the time. So, so that's just another thing that's shady thing that's happening. And if you have a publisher that's not on the ball like we are, and you start missing your royalties, you might want to raise a red flag with them.
So you've got some examples of some actual celebrity authors' works that were being thrust into litigation. Tell us about some of that.
The most famous case in history is John Steinbeck's family members. He wrote Grapes of Wrath and East of Eden. Even he died in 1968, but everybody's heard of him. When he died, he left his copyrights to his wife, and he left $50,000 to each of his sons. He had two sons. So his future copyrights went to his wife, $50,000 each for each kid.
Yep.
That was his intention anyway. Then things got down and dirty. After he died, and his wife was still alive, but she, her trustee, benefit, not beneficiary, trustee, it's somewhere in my notes here. She had a daughter before she married him, and she appointed her daughter to be, her daughter was in charge of her estate. So
executor.
So John Steinbeck's stepdaughter, who was born before he married his wife, became the executor of his wife's estate.
Okay.
And that was his wife's prerogative. She could put anybody in charge that she wanted. So things got down and dirty. And it went to court. Settlement was reached in 1983. I'm going to post a link to this gigantic article about this under writersweekly.com/podcast under this episode, because it's really fascinating, and you might want to pop some popcorn for that. One of Steinbeck's sons died in 1991. Now, remember, he died in 1968, so 78, 89, so 30-something years after his dad died, he died. Steinbeck's widow died in 2003. And even though everything had been settled in court years prior, things got ugly all over again. So now that ended in 2017. Remember, he died in 68. 2017 is when it all gets settled all over again. By that time, Steinbeck's other son had died as well. So other relatives, extended relatives, started fighting over the rights and royalties. Now remember, the stepdaughter had been the
executor.
Executor, thank you. That word's hard for me today. That led to other lawsuits, they all start fighting, getting about rights and royalties. Then there's other lawsuits, including accusations of slander of title. Now, Brian, what do you think slander of title means?
I've never even heard of that.
Well, if you had to
guess. Does that mean people are saying bad things about your book?
You know, that's immediately where my mind went.
Okay.
Now, if you're a famous author and somebody's, quote, slandering your title, how could that hurt your beneficiary's future income?
I don't know. I mean, can't people say I didn't like this book? It sucked.
Sure.
I mean, I assume you could make the argument that because somebody was saying bad things about the book, it won't sell as much and you're going to lose money.
Or it might not get a movie deal.
Oh, good Lord.
Okay, so slander of title, tortious interference. That means one company comes and tries to ruin a contract that another company already has. Mm-hmm. Loss of movie deals. This is all involved in this lawsuit. You name it. These relatives came up with anything and everything they could throw at the court. Again, click on the link under this episode. The relative, Steinbeck's stepdaughter, she was awarded $13.1 million.
From who?
From the relatives who went to court after her over and over again, trying to get those rights away from her that her mother gave to her. And
I wonder if they had the $13 million to pay her.
Well, I think 9.1 of that was punitive damages. Yeah. But they kept her in court for so long that she lost out on movie deals.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah. Wow. And now remember, so she finally, after years and years of hell, got $13.1 million, and she wasn't even a blood relative of his, because her mother did it right.
Yeah.
And then, but this shows how egregious and greedy some people can be. They had no rights to those books or those royalties whatsoever. Lord knows how much those people spent on legal fees. In fact, I wonder if those lawyers took it on contingency thinking they could win and the lawyers end up with nothing. You know, they probably deserved that. So,
well, there's a quote about this from jdsupra.com.
That's the website that I'm going to link underneath where it tells lots of details about this. Go ahead.
It says, the litigation as epic and sprawling as any of Steinbeck's novels demonstrates what can go wrong when an estate fight spills over into the next generation of heirs and control ends up in the hands of sometimes unexpected individuals.
Now, everybody think about that. When you're deciding who you're going to put in charge of your rights and royalties, you need to choose the right person. Because if you don't, and if they don't do it the right way, this kind of thing can happen to your family. Probably not to the tune of $13.1 million, but you never know. You never know who's listening to our podcast. It could be somebody. Yeah. You know.
And in this situation, you've got millions in royalties at stake.
Oh, yeah.
That just not only for the current generation, but future generations. And a good move would have been to assign a neutral third party to administer the author's estate, not a relative.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that could have helped avoid a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, a third party could have helped them all navigate the family animosity that was happening. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So why is it important for authors to assign their rights and future royalties to a responsible person, as if the last example wasn't enough?
Well, some parents, I hate to sound crass, but it's not a very smart thing to do. Let's say you've got a kid who's a doctor and a kid who's a functioning autistic kid. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in your doctor kid has a lot of money. They don't need your money.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to have to pay for lawyers and everything. So you go to LegalZoom.com and you fill out a will and you leave everything to your autistic kid because the autistic kid's going to need the money in the future.
Yep.
Is the autistic kid going to be able to handle all this stuff in court? No, they're not.
Yeah.
So they're going to have to hire a lawyer to help them. In the meantime, while your doctor kid is probably just going to be just fine with everything, your other relatives could come out of the woodwork and try to hoodwink,
start manipulating
your special needs kid, and turn it into a huge mess for years and years, and your special needs kid will, you know, probably end up with nothing.
Yeah.
So in this example, special needs kid, doctor kid's busy, has a family of his own, lives far away, whatever. That's when you want a third party controlling the trust that is supposed to be taking care of the special needs kid.
Yep.
And that will usually stop those greedy extended relatives from coming. Once they pick up the phone and realize they have to talk to a lawyer, they're probably not going any farther.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Having an attorney, and I think attorneys, you know, can set a one-time fee for you to, you know, have them deal with this down the road, or they can, I guess, pull some of their fees out of, you know, an agreed upon amount out of those monies that they're dealing with. But, you know, a disinterested third party that understands this stuff.
Yeah.
That has no emotional ties to this, you know, and again, can be held criminally liable if they do something wrong.
Right.
Whereas
exactly.
One of your relatives can't be held criminally liable for that.
Right.
I mean, it takes a lot of hoop jumping to get there, but
it wouldn't be so far of a stretch if you leave Aunt Margaret in charge of everything, trusting that she's going to take care of your kid.
Yeah.
And then Aunt Margaret marries some dude who is a very bad person.
Uh-huh.
And Aunt Margaret ends up making some bad decisions, or this guy forces her to make bad decisions, and still your kid ends up with nothing.
Cuts all your family out of that.
Hire a professional to take care of everything.
I believe Harper Lee was one of these.
These are examples that Google pulled up for us. Why don't you read about Harper Lee? These are famous authors who estates were embroiled in lawsuits.
All right, so Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, her estate has been involved in several legal disputes, including one against the production company behind a Broadway adaptation of the novel. And the estate alleged that the play deviated too significantly from the original story and characters, violating the terms of the contract that was signed by Lee before her death. The dispute was eventually settled, and the play went on to be a commercial and critical success, and the estate was also involved in a separate lawsuit with Lee's agent over royalties.
Yeah, see, there's another
thing. Everybody wants your royalties.
Yeah, that's another thing. If an author is very successful and they have an agent, they got traditional contracts, and they have an agent, and that agent's crooked, and that agent's getting all that money in, but the author dies, and the agent's not sending the proceeds out to the author's heirs, then, that's a problem, too. And as much as you would hope that, you know, all literary agents are honest, the fact is, in every industry, you know, there's some crooked ones. So, you know, that wouldn't be the first literary agent to keep money that was supposed to be paid out to a family.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, Angie, we got another one here.
Jack Kerouac, which you said his name sounds like what?
sounds like that stuff you take to make yourself puke. Kerouac.
Jack Kerouac.
I don't know.
After his death in 1969, his estate was initially valued at just $1, but it grew to be worth millions. The inheritance became the subject of a lengthy legal battle. This has become quite a trend in today's topic. Kerouac's mother inherited the estate, and upon her death, it passed to his third wife. Interesting.
He wrote some stuff that basically reflected the culture of the beatniks, basically, back in like the late 50s, early 60s.
And he died when he was how old?
He died, I think, at 47. It says he wound up being alcoholic and kind of withdrawn from everything. He was really so basically your classic starving author.
Yeah.
Who basically died almost pretty much penniless.
Okay.
His stuff. I'm based on what I'm reading about him, it looks like he didn't really get caught on to until later.
Didn't really get noticed until
later. I mean, I don't know. It does say that he was kind of an unofficial, quote, spokesman, I guess, of the beat culture, but I don't know. But it says that he struggled with alcoholism, growing bitterness towards a counterculture movement. So it would make sense that, I guess, his estate wasn't really worth much until he died, and then all of a sudden it became very valuable. Anyway.
So, Kerouac's mother inherited the estate, and upon her death, it passed to his third wife. So, his mother was his beneficiary.
Yep.
And then when she died, it went to his third wife.
Okay.
Okay. Following the wife's death, so clearly the books are still selling.
Boy,
right?
Everybody's
croaking. Yeah. Following the wife's death, the estate was divided among her siblings. Her siblings. So this is his wife's siblings. Not even related to him by blood, okay?
Okay.
With Kerouac's youngest brother, related by blood, being named the administrator. However, a judge later ruled that the will leaving the estate to his wife was a fake. So when he died, There was no will leaving his estate to his wife. She took over, and nobody discovered for years and years that she was never supposed to take over anyway, which added another layer to the complex and ongoing legal dispute, which I can't even imagine how much money those relatives paid for that.
Yeah.
This next author is a little more popular.
Yeah, J.R.R. Tolkien. Everybody should know The Hobbit. If you weren't forced to read that book in school, chances are you've seen the movies. The Tolkien Estate and HarperCollins, which is a publishing company, sued Warner Brothers for copyright infringement and breach of contract in 2012, and they alleged that the studio had overstepped its rights by using Tolkien's characters in digital formats like online slot machines and games. The lawsuit seeking $80 million in damages was eventually settled amicably, and the estate was also successfully won a court order against a fan fiction author for copyright infringement related to their Lord of the Rings inspired work.
Okay, for all you fan fiction authors out there, what you're doing ain't legal.
Yeah.
And you can get sued. Yeah, we won't publish books of fan fiction because we know what's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're a fan fiction author who's not really getting recognized very much, you're probably flying under the radar. But if people start liking your stuff a lot and somebody can say, well, you know, that's a lot like, you know, our work.
Well, a lot of fan fiction authors don't even try to hide the fact that it's those characters. Yeah. I know it's fun. And it can get you some tension online, and you can have a website, and you can still get sued for your website. You can, yeah. I mean, fan fiction authors are just, I would never do that because, well, first of all, it's not very creative.
Yeah.
And second of all, you know, I wouldn't want to go to sleep every night wondering who's going to knock on my door tomorrow with a big fat envelope. So,
yeah. That's true.
So, what's interesting about this case is it wasn't even relatives or extended relatives that were taking advantage of his rights and his characters.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different company, online slots and games. So that was dumb.
Well, that's Warner Brothers. And I'm assuming what happened was after they... Now, I don't know the timeline of when the Lord of the Rings movies came out, but 2012 sounds just about right for that first one. And apparently, you know, I'm just kind of assuming, but it looks like, you know, they had the rights to make this movie and use his characters for that. But then they said, well, may as well make some slot online slot machines. And
I'm willing to bet that Warner Brothers subcontract that out, or slot company contact them and said, hey, can we do this? And Warner Brothers said, yeah, when they didn't have the right to
do
that.
I wonder if it was something like, a slot machine based on the movie with, you know, Bilbo Baggins on there or whatever, or Frodo or so, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the estate said, you know, wait a minute, we let you make a movie, but we didn't tell you you could run around selling this likeness and our title on all this other stuff for you to make money. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just, I'm assuming that's probably how that went.
Yeah.
Lithub.com.
And this is us wrapping everything up today. This is I found this online, and we're gonna post a link on it under writersweekly.com/podcast, under this podcast. This is an article you don't want to miss. This is an article I wish I'd written. This is fantastic.
So, well, it has there's an article penned by Emily Temple featuring 25 legendary literary feuds. And they're ranked, and the subtitle is "Ding, Ding, Ding, Let the Fight Begin."
Yeah.
and like Angie said, we're going to post a link under that episode on writersweekly.com/podcast. So what have we learned here today, Angie?
Save your heirs, the right ones, not the wrong ones. Lost sleep, pain, suffering, and thousands in legal fees by assigning a beneficiary for your copyrights or a trustee for your trust. As soon as you can get into a lawyer's office, or as soon as you can get on LegalZoom.com, you know, don't let your legacy tear your entire family apart. Because in many of these cases, and I'm not just talking best-selling authors who have a lot of money, it rips families apart.
Yeah.
And the very first example about the two guys who weren't even getting to get $60, I guarantee they don't talk to each other anymore.
Probably not.
All for, I think it was like $54 and... Yeah. 32 cents or something. Yeah.
It's amazing.
I know it.
Amazing.
Yep.
And again, all that because you just assumed there was some money there.
And all that because the author didn't do the paperwork ahead of time to protect his family from going through that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, why are we able to discuss all this legal stuff and get this deep in the weeds? Well, that's because we've been in business for, well, Angie's been in business for over 25 years. And if you have a book you want to publish and you want a safe place to do it without having to spend an arm and a leg like a lot of other publishing companies, why don't you check out booklocker.com? By now, if you've been listening to the podcast, you should know we kind of know what we're doing.
And if something happens to you, we're going to do whatever we can to take care of your rights and royalties and make sure they go to the exact right person or exact right trust or exact right law firm. We're not going to just, oh, okay, niece so-and-so, nephew so-and-so. We're going to make sure that your rights and royalties
are
taken care
of. We protect your interests. Yep. You're considered part of the, almost like a family member, not just, you know, somebody that's paid us one time for us to publish a book and then we're done with you. It's everybody, we take care of them.
Everybody at Book Locker is a family member to us. And we take care of them even after they die. And we work with a lot of elderly authors. We lose several authors every year.
Yeah.
And it's sad, but we make sure they're taken care of. Their things are taken care of even after they're gone.
Exactly.
Yeah. Today was our start time for our summer 2025 24-hour short story contest. And you can sign up for the fall contest. Of course, it's too late to sign up for the summer contest. But I believe that's scheduled for September 20th. And only 500 people are allowed to participate. 24hourshortstorycontest.com or go to writersweekly.com. There's a horizontal ad up there for the fall contest where you can click to join that. So for the next 6 weeks, we're going to be reading and judging short stories, and I can't wait because the topic's fantastic.
There you go.
Yeah.
And what happened was at noon Central Time, Angela sent out basically a very short beginning for a story, and then everybody has the next 24 hours to write a short story based on that beginning, and it's entirely up to them where that story goes. And in 24 hours, it shuts down. If you didn't get your entry in by then, you're out of luck.
Yeah. Do you want to hear the topic?
Oh, can you read? I didn't want to give away the topic. Go ahead.
Well, we released it at noon Central Time today, so it's on the website.
I didn't know that I was authorized to do this.
Oh, okay. 24hourshortstorycontest.com. This is only up for 24 hours, but the topic for today's contest is, did she just see what she thought she saw? She stepped off the path, intending to only walk a few feet. It was only later that the group noticed she was missing. They quickly backtracked, yelling her name. Tensions rose as the sun began to set. And that's when they, too, saw... ..
Where would you go with that? Not you. Where would you take that? Think about that. That's the kind of stuff that we throw out there for people to get their creative juices going. And like I said, they have 24 hours to write a story and get that back to us.
And you only need to touch on that topic in some way to qualify. You can change the gender of the main character. You can change who the main character is. You only need to touch on that topic in some way to qualify.
Yep. And it's always interesting to see what people come up with.
Oh, and this one is maximum of 850 words.
850
each
words?
One has a word count. So yeah.
That's why they call it a short story.
Right. So it's a fun weekend for us. We love contest weekends.
All right. And with that, tonight's dinner is going to be venison tenderloin with a blueberry sauce and a special kind of mashed potatoes that's, I think it's a Scandinavian dish, and I forget what it's called. But
I'm
making Angela tonight. So it's time for us to wrap this up and get out of here. Thank you very much for listening to the Writers Weekly Podcast, and we will see you all again next week.
See you later.
Take care. Bye-bye.